is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the story behind the story, the news behind the news, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at and illusion is usually king. But the battle for survival of Western civilization is going to be reality and not illusion or delusion. That'll determine just what the future will bring. Now, I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And if you have any questions, we welcome your calls. And I think you can probably call in 15, 20 minutes after the hour here, 464-8295 or 1-888-24-LIBERTY. But let me tell you that we're in for a very special treat this evening because we have with us Dr. Gordon Edwards, who is an ornithologist, and people are going to say, what's an ornithologist, and why would anybody be interested in ornithology? But before this evening is over, I think that we will challenge many of your previous misconceptions about the environmental movement, of Rachel Carson and her book, The Silent Spring, which began the environmental movement, and the outlawing of DDT, which was probably one of the greatest tragedies of modern time. Dr. Edwards, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Can you hear me all right?
A little bit faint, but I think I can hear you all right.
All right, let me just turn that up just a little bit. And basically, Dr. Edwards has been at San Jose State for many years. He is a professor there. He's retired now, but he's still teaching courses. And just sort of introduce yourself to our audience and tell our audience a little bit about yourself.
Yes, I am. I did start as an ornithologist, and in fact, I helped teach the course in ornithology at Ohio State as a graduate student. But my major was botany as an undergraduate in Indiana. And when I got out of the Army in 1945, I went to Ohio State to major in entomology as a graduate student. And my special interest was beetle identification, and I got into medical entomology also. Can you hear me all right?
I can hear you fine, but I'm going to have Kevin call you back again just a moment because you've got a little hum on the line. I really want to get just as clear as we possibly can. So if you'll hang up, Kevin will call you right back.
Okay.
Okay, fine. Okay, Kevin, if you wouldn't mind just calling Dr. Edwards back again just to make sure we've got the best possible line that we can. Okay, fine. Well, basically, the story you're going to hear this evening is the story of one of the greatest frauds ever perpetrated upon modern mankind. And let's see if this is any better. Dr. Edwards?
Yes.
I think that's much better. Can you hear me any better?
Sure.
Okay, fine. Well, anyway, let's go ahead now. Of course, you're talking about, you've been in biology and beetle identification, but what got your interest up in this whole matter of the outlawing of DDT? At what point did you begin to question the commonly accepted concept that DDT was a terrible drug and was killing off the birds and the beetles and the insects and was going to eventually lead to the destruction of the population of the sea?
Yes. Well, it was an interesting thing to me. I was working on a grant at the Jackson Hole Research Station in Wyoming in the summers. And that was 1960, 61, 62. 1962, when Rachel Carson's book Silent Spring was published, I read about it in the New Yorker magazine had some extracts from it. And I was entirely on her side because I'd always been an environmentalist, Nature Studies Club of Indiana, and Audubon Society and Christmas bird counts and things like that. And I thought it was great. And I was all on her side, and I came back to San Jose to teach school that fall, and I got a copy of the book, and I read through it. I kept seeing things that I knew were not right, but I was very forgiving because, after all, she was one of us. And I guess I got through 180 pages or so, and I just, I think the thing that turned me off first was her mention of medical entomology, where all she talked about was... she mentioned a couple of diseases that DDT wouldn't help anyway. And since I was teaching medical entomology, I was concerned about malaria and yellow fever and typhus and plague and encephalitis and all those things that are transmitted by insects. And I thought it's awful that she didn't mention those. She talked like our problems with diseases are okay because of a better health and better sanitation and so forth. So I began to think that maybe I wasn't on her side. But still, going to Audubon Society meetings and Sierra Club meetings, and everybody was saying how wonderful Rachel Carson was, and I didn't want to get into any big fights about it, so I didn't say much about it, but I had my opinions building up. I finally went through the book again and analyzed it. Each time I saw something I thought was wrong, I looked up the original reference, and I found that I really couldn't go along with what she was doing. I didn't know why she was doing it, but it was too much for me.
Well, now, at one point in your dissertation, you point out from an article in the Life Sciences that in little more than two decades, DDT prevented 500 million deaths due
Correct.
To malaria. So this is certainly one of the greatest boons to mankind we ever saw. And, of course, with the outlawing of DDT, we've suddenly seen a tremendous resurgence in malaria. Now, as you went through the book, you pointed out that much of the material that had been put out really wasn't right. In other words, we were led to believe that DDT was actually preventing birds from having normal eggs. The newborn chickens or chicks were not hatching, and we were getting the thinning of the eggs. And this was one of the big things that we were told over and over again. DDT leads to thinning of the eggs. And, of course, is killing off the birds. What's the truth of the matter?
I had always heard that, too. And when she mentioned DeWitt, for example, who had done some work on quail feeding them DDT, and I looked up his article, too, and I the thing that really got to me, she had said that DDT into her, pardon me, quail into whose diet DDT was introduced had produced a normal number of fertile eggs, but few of the eggs hatched. This may seem like a minor thing, but when I looked at the records, I saw that 80% had hatched, and in the controls with no DDT, only 83.9% had hatched. And I remember thinking, maybe she said fewer instead of few, because I couldn't think of 80% hatched as being few of the eggs hatching. But it turned out she really did mean to say few of the eggs hatched, and she omitted entirely the part where he had fed pheasants DDT. And the ones that were fed DDT hatched 80% of their eggs, and the controls with no DDT only hatched 57% of their eggs.
Well, now,
that's when I really began to see that she was not really being truthful.
Well, now, what about the thinning of the eggshells? This is one of the big things. In fact, up until recently, I'd always believed that DDT-fed birds had very thin shells.
Yes. Yes, I was interested in that also, and so I got the articles. I think the thing to do is you should always get the article and read it like you really want to find the truth. And unfortunately, it turned out that she was not being very truthful about that either. It turns out that if you give the birds a high diet of DDT and otherwise treat them well, they do just as well, lay eggs with the shells just as thick as any normal bird. But if you cut the calcium in the diet, or cut the light, or add something else, or deprive them of water, all kinds of things like that, or add any number of other chemicals that are known to inhibit eggshell production, you can get these birds to lay thin shelled eggs. And if your goal is to ban DDT, of course, that's what you want. So we had quite a group of people who were carrying out experiments that were designed to show eggshell thinning, and then they could blame it on DDT. And that bothered me as a scientist. You know, I have never taught courses in insect control using DDT, but I think I could see what they were trying to do, and I didn't like it.
In other words, they were using science to accomplish a political end.
Correct.
And, of course, you talked about the robins, and the DDT was killing the robins at Michigan State University or Michigan State campus. What's the real story there?
Well, this was actually the first actual bird story, I guess, that I saw. It was a fellow named George Mitchell, I think his name is George, at Michigan State campus, and he was reporting that the robins were being killed because they were spraying they were spraying four Dutch elm disease, which is transmitted by bark beetles, and they were spraying the elm trees to kill the bark beetles, and that would prevent the elm disease from being transmitted. And I have always liked elm trees, so I had nothing against spraying elm trees. But what George Weller said, this was in 1959 or 1960, said this was killing the robins on the Michigan State campus. Now, I was at Ohio State, of course, and also I was visiting University of Illinois and many other schools that had the elm trees being sprayed, and they didn't have dead robins. And being, I thought, a scientist, I thought if DDT is killing robins at Michigan State University, it should be killing robins everywhere else where it's being sprayed. And that made me suspicious. And I found that they were using a lot of mercury in the soil, and so the robins were eating contaminated earthworms that had mercury, and the symptoms they displayed were actually attributable to mercury poisoning. But Wallace and other people were saying that this was because of DDT, causing them to go into tremors and die. And that didn't make sense to me as a scientist. I thought if it happens one place, it should happen everywhere else where the same things are happening.
And, of course, commented that actually to test the birds for DDT, they put them in cold storage for a while. Then they used the total chlorine method of analysis of the dead birds to estimate how much of the chlorine resulted from DDC in the bird tissue. That doesn't sound like very good science.
No, that has been the whole situation, the whole process. They start by saying it kills birds, and then if you don't find the birds dying, next they could say, well, it may prevent them from reproducing well by causing to produce, dead embryos and eggs. And when that doesn't happen, then they finally got around to saying that it might cause thin eggshells. And went from one thing to the other. And each thing they went to, I became more suspicious and looked more carefully at the literature.
Well, now, at one point you point out on page 118 of Rachel Carson's book, she says, like the robin, another American bird, the bald eagle seems to be on the verge of extinction.
Yes.
And, of course, what's the answer to that?
Well, that bothered me, too, because Roger Torrey Peterson, who was a friend of mine when he was alive, he recently died, unfortunately, but Roger Torrey Peterson pointed out that the robin was the most abundant bird in North America. And he wrote that in his book on Life series called Life Nature Magazine. And when he said that, I thought, that's the same year that Rachel Carson wrote Silent Spring. And I believed him instead of her. She said the robin and the bald eagle are on the verge of extinction, and he said it's the most abundant bird in North America. That simply confirmed even more what I was thinking about her writing in Silent Spring.
And, of course, you pointed out that the eagle, the bald eagle, had declined before DDT was ever used, and after DDT was sprayed...
You're right about that, yes.
The bald eagle came back again.
And they gave credit for the ban on DDT for the bald eagles coming back. But the bald eagles were really not, well, it depends on where you are. In Alaska, the bald eagles were extremely abundant. In fact, there's an Ecology Magazine article in 1921, maybe it was 1923, I think 1921. The title was The Threatened Extinction of the Bald Eagle. And the Alaska legislature enacted a bounty, 50 cents per eagle, for people would kill bald eagles up there. And the number of bounties they paid was almost 130,000 dead eagles. But that was in the 1920s. Now, in this country, there were still not many eagles, and I had a record in Bird Lore magazine, 1930, saying this would give some idea of the rarity of the eagle in eastern United States. They gave records like not more than 25 in Ohio, 10 in Pennsylvania, 15 or 20 along Chesapeake Bay, and no records in most of New England. And when I read that, and then I thought, she's trying to blame bald eagles becoming scarce, blame it on DDT, but DDT wasn't developed for 25 years after that. So that bothered me, too.
Well, then, of course, they did all sorts of scientific studies to come up with the conclusion they wanted to. And one point you talked about pheasant sickness and how they fed these poor pheasants 15,000 parts of DDT per million. And I think the average individual, you said, would get something like 0.03 parts per million. So they're giving these poor pheasants 15,000 parts per million.
That was amazing.
It really was.
Yeah, now this is work by Rudd and Jenley, published in Condor magazine. By the way, I think I've read every issue of all the so-called bird magazines, Condor and Auk and Ibis and Bird Lore, of course, and Audubon. And I always paid a lot of attention to those magazines. But in Condor magazine in 1955, Rudd and Jenley were writing about the effect of effect of DDT on pheasants. And specifically, they were concerned about DDT being applied to rice fields in California. And so Rachel Carson, I have her quote here, she said, "Pheasant sickness became a well-known phenomenon. Birds seek water, become paralyzed, and are found in the ditch banks quivering, according to one observer." And I wasn't too impressed by that reference. According to one observer can mean anything, as far as I'm concerned. But the one observer was not a good, credible scientific source. Anyway, she was referring to work by Rudd and Jenley, and I looked at their work in Condor magazine and have copies of it. They had a pen with 12 pheasants, and they put food in the pen. It was ad libitum. They didn't keep any record of how many pheasants ate what kind of food. They just put it in the pen, and the pheasants could eat what they wanted. But the dosage of DDT in that pen, I thought it was a mistake when I first read it. 1.5 pounds of DDT for 100 pounds of rice. And I would have thought maybe I misread it, but Red himself stated, and this is a quote, "This concentration is equivalent to 15,000 parts per million of DDT in the diet," unquote.
Now, there's no way that a bird ordinarily could get anything like that.
And they'd be lucky if they got 15 parts per million
right.
in their food. But at that dose, I would expect any bird that ate that to die of something, either directly or indirectly. But there were 12 pheasants, and 7 of them survived, and 5 showed no symptoms. And as a biologist, I simply assumed that the ones that didn't show any symptoms probably didn't eat anything. The ones that ate a lot of the DDT in the rice, maybe could have been killed, although we usually think that you can't kill a bird with DDT in their diet.
Okay, fine. Now, of course, you point out that the book, The Silent Spring, was dedicated by Rachel Carson to that great humanitarian, Albert Schweitzer. And she used the quotation, "Man has lost the capacity to foresee and to forestall. He will end by destroying the earth." And, of course, she was attributing, at least you would assume, since this book was on environmentalism and the danger of pesticides, you would assume that Dr. Schweitzer was talking about the danger to humanity from DDT and other pesticides. Let me read that quotation again. "Man has lost the capacity to foresee and to forestall. He will end by destroying the earth." That's the quotation of Albert Schweitzer. What's the truth of the matter?
That was on the first page of her book. She dedicated a book to him.
Right.
And I thought it was great to dedicate a book to Albert Schweitzer. He's a great man. But by that time I was very suspicious of Rachel Carson. So I got Schweitzer's autobiography to see if he really did mention DDT. I thought maybe he didn't even mention it. But he did on page 262 in his autobiography. His quote is, "How much labor and waste of time these wicked insects do cause us. But a ray of hope in the use of DDT is now held out to us."
And, of course, that quotation from Schweitzer was really referring to atomic power, atomic bombs, having nothing to do with insecticides. But she left she left the reader with a false impression.
Yeah, so he did appreciate DDT because he was working in Africa and, of course, trying to protect people from various diseases down there. DDT is the cheapest way to protect people at that time, anyway. It was very effective.
Do we have anything else that's effective and cheap today?
Well, with a lot more money, the World Health Organization experimented trying to find a good substitute for DDT, and they tested 1,400 chemicals. And they found that chlordane was pretty good, and carbaryl, which we know as 7, carbaryl was pretty good, but it cost about 7 times as much, and chlordane cost 4 or 5 times as much as DDT. And the countries were so poor they could hardly afford the DDT at 17 cents a pound. So there really was no effective substitute that they could afford to use.
Okay, and so, today an awful lot of people are dying needlessly because of Rachel Carson and because of the environmental movement and the fact that they were effectively able to ban a very, very safe insecticide some 30 years ago. Now, you go on and you talk about the Environmental Defense Fund, and this is one of these activist organizations, environmental organizations that are largely funded by the great foundations. And what did you find out about them? In other words, were they sincere? Were they really using legitimate science, or were they using science to push a political agenda?
Well, they were funded by the Audubon Society because the Audubon Society didn't want to lose their tax-exempt status by lobbying. The Environmental Defense Fund could lobby, and that wouldn't bother the Audubon Society's taxable, their tax-exempt status. And EDF became a very very popular organization, very wealthy. They had enough money to pay Victor Yanukone, their chief attorney, one of the founders, was paid $60,000 a year for part-time work. And they had a fellow named Charles Worster, who was the chief biologist. He listed his specialty in American Men of Science, 1960, said he was, his specialty was jet fuels and fuel luminosity, but in the EDF he became the biologist. And they're still very active and still powerful. I talked to members of the EDF. At one time I suggested they might try to ban parathion, because parathion is much more deadly, and TDT has never killed a single person in the world. And I said, if you're working to ban parathion, I might be on your side. And they said, we don't want you on our side. But I never did get on their side. However, I was impressed that they told me that there were too many people in the tropics, and they're multiplying too fast. And if you saved them from malaria, they'd simply starve to death later, or else live to reproduce another generation.
And so basically, these men, these so-called scientists, were telling you that one justification for outlawing DDT was it would cause an awful lot of people to die, that there were basically too many people in the world?
Yes, and that's I can see there are too many people in the world, but I guess I had two reasons for being opposed to that type of reasoning. One is I thought they should be able to cut the population by some other means, and the other is I hated to see a good insecticide being ostracized and banned, maybe, for no good reason. If they had said, we want to ban DDT because if we can do that, we can stop this population explosion in the third world, at least I would have felt they were truthful about it.
Well, you quote here Alexander King, the president of the Club of Rome, who said, my own doubts came when DDT was introduced in Guyana. Within 2 years, it had almost eliminated malaria. So my chief quarrel with DDT in hindsight is that it has greatly added to the population problem.
Yes,
that's a frightening quotation. Where did you get that from?
If I can tell you here.
Well, you don't. If you don't have it right at your fingertips.
No, I don't. I don't have a reference, but it's from the Club of Rome publication.
Okay, fine.
It's the president of the Club of Rome.
Well, I will attribute that to this treatise that you have. And incidentally, this is an excellent treatise. Is this available for people out here who would like to actually study this sort of thing? I believe this is the talk that you gave to Doctors to Defense Preparedness, where I first heard you speak.
Well, thank you. I'm glad you liked it. Yes, it hasn't been published. I've been making copies at the Xerox shop to send to friends. And 48 pages, I think. So I can't make many copies.
No, but in other words, would it be all right if somebody wanted a copy for me to copy one for them?
Yes, if they were to let me know, I could at least give them some pages, and who knows? Depends on how much interest there is.
Well, I from my point of view, I think it's fascinating, and I know I have some friends who write on this subject, and I would think that they would be fascinated by it. Now, why don't you tell us about the brown pelican? Because, you know, all these birds, they kept bringing up this bird and that bird and the next bird, and each one supposedly was being destroyed by DDT. What's the
DDT, yes.
What's the background of the brown pelican?
Well, I got interested in brown pelicans, of course, as soon as I came to California. Said they were great. And used to enjoy seeing them dive. And the pelican did very well on Anacapa Island. They also had a colony out on San Nicolas Island, and as we found, when we were supposed to find it, we found a copy on Santa Cruz Island, a colony also. However, the ones on Anacapa were the major colony, and I've read all the bird articles about how abundant they were at different years, going back to 1930s, and up to 1969, They did very well. We had a man from University of California taking his classes out there to study them the year before that, and said they were in good shape. They did put a foghorn up that year, which may have had some effect, but the pelicans are apparently still doing well. And then on the 28th of January, 1969, the Santa Barbara oil spill started, and the oil surrounded Anacapa Island. That was the island where the major pelican colony was located. And later, I think it was that spring, 2 months later, some biologists went out to the island. They were surprised. They said that the brown pelican colony has a lot of softer broken eggshells in and near the nest. And they thought immediately DDT must be wiping out the pelicans.
You don't think there was some sort of a preconceived notion there?
First thing they would think. And so that that bothered me, and I began to study the pelicans in more detail. And everything I looked at indicated that they were doing well until the oil spill. And this was what I was especially interested in. So at one time, as a matter of fact, I chartered a plane, and Rick Main, who was one of my students and colleagues, Rick Main and Dr. Harvey, ecology professor at San Jose State, Tom Harvey, and I flew out around the Channel Islands. That's when we found this colony on Santa Cruz Island that they were trying to keep quiet. Like, we were going around Santa Cruz Island, and the pilot said I could cut across the middle of the island, and he did, and all of a sudden there's a pelican colony on Lizard Rock down the edge of Santa Cruz, and they weren't even supposed to be on that island. But meanwhile, the ones on Anacapa Island were having trouble, and for various reasons, I think. The pelicans diving through the oil to pick up food, and the food was contaminated with mercury. The anchovies, they analyzed, said they had 17 parts per million of mercury in the anchovies, and they also found high levels of mercury in the oil that was floating on the surface. And the level in the oil was about 21 parts per million, according to Dietrich, who announced at the international conference in Ann Arbor in 1970. So diving through the oil, I thought, was going to have a bad effect on the birds, and also going back to the nest with oil in the wings is not good for the eggs. In fact, it would cause the eggs not to even hatch. It'll kill the fetus inside. But all this was ignored. Robert Finley, who was in charge of the fish, wildlife, pelican studies throughout the United States, didn't like my criticism. I didn't testify before two congressional committees, and Congressman Polk's committee was in 1971. And when Finley heard about my comments on the brown pelican, he wrote to say there's not a shred of evidence that spilled oil is capable of causing thin eggshells or otherwise affecting bird reproduction. That's a quote from his letter. And I had all the literature here on what effect oil does have on eggs. Hartnung in Journal of Wildlife Management, good publication, said oil reduces hatchability by 68%. The National Wildlife Federation certainly is not in favor of DDT, but they said oil in the parents' feathers causes embryo mortality. And a fellow named King in the Bulletin of Environmental Contamination Toxicology said that oil is the cause of pelican mortality for 6 weeks after a spill. And Dieter said oil in eggs kills 76 to 98% of the embryos, and the birds ingesting the oil produce 70 to 100% fewer eggs than normal, and they have liver and spleen atrophy resulting. And on, Sorrow said oil causes kidney nephrosis, pancreatic degeneration, and lipid pneumonia. All this in spite of the fact that Robert Finley, in charge, said there's not a shred of evidence that spilled oil is capable of causing thin-shelled eggs or otherwise affecting bird reproduction.
In other words, it all was the DDT.
Yeah, the oil. And by the way, after the oil spill, there was a great reduction in the number of pelicans, but it was helped along by the environmentalists, I'll say biologists, from the Fish and Wildlife and the California Fish and Game, who are out there collecting the intact eggs to analyze them and see what concentration of DDT was in the eggs. And they said they collected over 70% of the intact eggs for analysis.
And then they wondered why there weren't so many pelicans.
Yeah, that would make a reduction in the population for sure.
Right. We're going to be back in just a moment
okay.
With Dr. Gordon Edwards.
Amen.
this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and we want to tell you about a few of the items that we have that we hope that you'll want to get that will help you to better understand what indeed is going on in the crazy world in which we live today. And of course, we have a number of tapes. One of them, of course, is on population control, a talk I gave up in, I believe, Milwaukee, probably December of last year, and we have a little pamphlet that goes along with that that just will take you some of the quotations that we've taken out of the literature, publications from the negative population control people who really want to get the world population down to 2 billion. Now, ask yourself, how are we ever going to get the world population down to 2 billion people? And then, of course, we'll take you to the Georgia Guidestones in Elberton, Georgia, give you the material that I got when I went to Elberton, and you'll find out there are people who would like to get the world population down to 500 million. And it's not just the inscription on the Georgia Guidestones, but it's the quotations that come from people like Sam Keen, who was the director of one of the workshops at the Gorbachev Summit held at the Presidio last year, and we'll give you the sources of reference for all of this material. So you can call 1-800-5-HIV-WAR and ask for the tape on population control. Now, there are a number of other tape sets there, a tape set on China. And if you haven't heard our tape set on China, talks were given some 35 years ago by Reverend Millen, who was in China at the time of the communist takeover. These are certainly classics. And then, of course, our tape series on Vietnam, The Untold Story. And if you have ever wondered what Vietnam was really all about, I mean, why did the mightiest nation in the world go to South Vietnam and spend 10 years fighting against a country the size of the state of Mississippi and lose that war? Well, if you think you really know what Vietnam was all about, I challenge you to listen to the tapes, and you'll never look at Vietnam through the same eyes again. A fascinating insight into the background of what goes on, and you'll even hear Colonel Bogreitz talking about what the commanding general over there in Vietnam told him about the war. And, of course, we recommend the Vietnam tapes, Waco, Oklahoma City, tapes on World War III, and the possibility that we will have another great war. Call 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. These tape sets, I promise you, will give you a whole different outlook on the world. We give you our permission to copy the tapes, distribute them, and help us to get the message of freedom out across America. Dr. Gordon Edwards, and he, a professor at San Jose State for many years, retired now, but still is teaching, and he's put together the most amazing treatise on ornithology and on DDT. And if you're out there in the listening audience and would like to call us, our number 464-8295 or 1-888-24-LIBERTY. If you're outside the Santa Cruz dialing area, give us a call. But this is a subject that's always really intrigued me, because we have heard over and over and over again the DDT actually causes thinning of the shells, and yet as you go through this treatise, you'll find that study after study after study puts a really points out that what Rachel Carson said just wasn't true. Now, what about the osprey? This is one of the things. The osprey is disappearing, and this is all because of DDT. What's the true story about that?
The osprey I was familiar with back in Indiana, and that was one of my favorite birds, watching him die for fish, you know.
Yes, sir.
And when I heard about the osprey being also, also being threatened, I was concerned, of course. I haven't gone back to the literature again. A man named J.J. Hickey, who wrote a book called Guide to Birdwatching in 1943, said there was a 70% decline of eastern ospreys because of pole trapping around fish hatcheries. Now, that consists of traps on top of poles, and the ospreys come in by the hatchery, and they land on the pole, and the trap gets them by the leg. So that caused a 70% decline, and that was before DDT was ever invented. So After DC was developed, then the same men ignored the full trapping and the shooting, which is also common, and blamed only DDT for all the declines of ospreys. And there's a group called the Hawk Mountain Sanctuary Association back at Hawk Mountain, Pennsylvania, and I've been a member of the association for a long time, and they count all the hawks that migrate south and north across Hawk Mountain, Pennsylvania. And year after year, we keep the figures of how many of each kind is migrating. Give some idea of which ones are common, which ones are scarce. And the ospreys were doing pretty well. 1946, when I got my first figure there, 191 migrated across. But 5 years later, there are 254. And 10 years after that, there are 352. And 5 years later, 457. And up to 529, and eventually up to 630 in 1972. And hard for me to believe that they are threatened with extinction. There are more every year. It was one more thing that convinced me that there's something not quite right with all these figures we hear from the Audubon Society and the environmentalists. And when more were migrating every year, I thought, and setting new all-time records in several of those years. After it was banned, the Sanctuary Association newsletter in 1976, I had their report. They said, for reasons we do not understand at all, the number of osprey going south is returning to something like normal. That is, it dropped from 630, it dropped down to 318 in 1974, 279 in 1975, and it's remained about there ever since then. So I thought, here's another case where they're saying the osprey is endangered because of DDT, when all the time it was the greatest decline was before DDT was ever developed, and during the DDT years, the ospreys were getting more abundant all the time.
That bothers me. Now, what about PCB? What effect does that have? What is PCB, and is this really a much more toxic chemical than DDT?
Yes. I have a hard time hearing that, but I think you asked me if there were other chemicals that are more toxic than DDT.
Well, PCB, specifically PCB.
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear that.
Specifically PCBs.
PCBs.
Yes.
Yes. Now, they're very, very widespread. And unfortunately, they give the same reading on the gas chromatograph as DDT and DDE. So the early analyses of DDT, in some cases they thought there was a lot of DDT, but later, after they could reanalyze it with new equipment, they found that there are more PCBs than there was DDT. Now, PCBs are found in, well, a lot of things. They're plasticizers and expanders, and they're found in fluorescent light ballasts and things like that. And also in rubber tires and almost everywhere. And in plastic, if you get a sample in a plastic bag and analyze it, the PCBs in the plastic will regulate the results, so you think you've got DDT in the sample. So misidentification of chemicals has been a big problem.
Now, what about the persistence of DDT in the environment? We've heard that DDT gets in the lake, it kills all the fish, and you have the silent spring, as it were.
Yes. Well, when people ask me that, I have to say under what conditions, because it disappears very rapidly in some conditions and lasts a long time in other conditions. If you keep it out of the sunlight, away from ultraviolet, and away from moisture, it'll last for several years in the soil. But if it's out in the open, and especially if it's alkaline soil, I remember in Southern California, they used to deliver a shipment of DDT to a farm. And if nobody was home, they just had to take it back, because if they left it out, the heat and the alkalinity would destroy it before dark. So it varies. However, the greatest experiment on it, I think, was by Nash, published in Science Magazine, I believe it was. And first he sterilized the soil, because we knew that soil microorganisms destroy DDT. So you sterilize the soil first, and you put the DDT in the soil, and then you keep it out of the light so ultraviolet can't hit the soil, and don't let any moisture get on the soil. And what Nash and Wilson did, took a sample every year and analyzed it, and after 17 years, they found about half of the DDT was gone from that soil. And this was stretched in by the Environmental Defense Fund to begin to say it has a half-life of 30 years. And under those conditions, I suppose that's probably right. But you never find those conditions in nature. So if you go out and spray your lettuce with DDT, you'd have to spray it again before the end of the growing season, and that goes down in the sun a lot. So it depends on the conditions. But generally speaking, I would say DDT has a half-life that's somewhere between a week and maybe 2 months under normal conditions. It's now, broken down by a lot of things.
Now, how about DDT in the ocean or DDT in the Monterey Bay area sanctuary?
We're told,
you know, the DDT is here, and of course it's there, and it's always going to be there, and it's always going to be a hazard to our fish and our salmon and our little clams.
Well, the best experiment I know of was done by the EPA at Gulf Breeze, Florida. And they took DDT and put it into a large glass container and lowered the containers into the ocean. And so they have the right temperature and the right illumination and so forth. And then it took a sample about every 2 or 3 days to take a sample. And they found that in 38 days, over 90% of the DDT was gone. And not only that, but it had broken down into DDE and DDD, and they in turn had disappeared. So the best I can give you on the ocean persistence is something like 30 or 40 days would be maximum survival in a normal ocean condition in salt water.
Okay, now would the fish, do fish have DDT in them?
Pardon me?
Do fish have DDT?
Well, yes. They will take fish in through the gills, but not very much through their mouth. They eat food that has DDT in it. Most of it passes through the digestive tract and is eliminated. But what they breathe and what they take into the gills gets into the blood supply and does stay there. It is broken down in several different pathways, so they don't keep it forever. But generally, the bigger the fish, the more water comes through the gills and the more DDT is going to be in the body.
Okay, but even if you and I were to eat that fish, we're not going to get in any trouble, are we?
No, because, we wouldn't eat the part that has the most DDT anyway. But if we eat the muscles of the fish, which we normally do, wouldn't get very much concentration of DDT in the muscles. And if you did, most of it passes through your body and the rest is eliminated. It's metabolized, and you get rid of it pretty fast. So you can eat DDT every day, same amount every day, and at the end of, let's say, 5 years, you'll have about the same amount you did at the end of a month or two.
Now, of course, we always hear DDT in the food chain, you know, and the littlest organism is eaten by the next biggest organism and the next biggest organism, and suddenly you have this whole chain, each one ingesting more and more and more DDT. What's the truth of that?
Well, it takes a long time to discuss, but I can summarize it maybe by saying if you analyze the muscle of the fish and then analyze the muscle in the duck that eats the fish, instead of analyzing the fat tissue in the duck, analyze the muscle in the duck, and then analyze the muscle in a predator that eats the duck, you're going to find really no magnification. The level's going to be about the same or even maybe a little bit lower in the eagle than it will be in the fish.
And isn't that because when you ingest the DDT and it goes to your digestive tract, it's actually metabolized?
Right. Now, the way they make it look like it's been a magnification, they take the crustaceans. They usually start with something small. Take the crustacean, analyze those with wet weight, and then you analyze the fish dry weight muscles. And, of course, if it's wet weight, the water is going to be diluting the amount of DDT, so you have a very low concentration in the crustacea, a much higher concentration in the muscle of the fish because there's no water to dilute it. But from there on, they take the duck and analyze only the fatty tissue, the lipids, because lipids do attract more DDT than muscle. And then to make it even better, they can analyze the brain of the predator, the eagle or the osprey. Just the brain, because brain concentrates more DDT than fat tissue does. So doing all these things together, it might end up with 600 times more DDT in the brain of the eagle than was in the muscle of the fish. And they call that biological magnification.
Okay, now what about the EPA hearings? How did they go about actually getting DDT outlawed when it was quite obvious that it really wasn't doing any harm and it was saving countless hundreds of millions of lives throughout the world?
Yes, we followed the hearings very closely at Ruckelshaus. I think he thought if he holds these hearings, he's going to have a good case against DDT, and then he can ban it. We knew that he wanted to ban it. He'd given speeches to the Audubon Society, and he was a member of the Environmental Defense Fund. So he held the hearings in 1970 and 71. And what happened during the hearings was all these people testifying with phony facts and figures. And well, just maybe one example might be a good one. They asked a fellow named Woodwell, who had been the co-author with Charles Worster, an article in the Science magazine, and the article said that the abstract said DDT residues in an extensive salt marsh on the south shore of Long Island average more than 13 pounds per acre at the end of the abstract quote. So the U.S. Department of Agriculture attorney was cross-examining Woodwell, said, isn't it a fact that you continued your samplings and found you were getting an average of only 1 pound per acre? And Woodwell said, no, I wouldn't agree with that. And they asked him again, did you find that the area where you took your sample was an area for the Mosquito Abatement Commission spray truck to clean out also? And the answer was, I can't say I discovered that either. I don't believe there's any evidence to that effect. And the question then by the attorney was, Dr. Worster, perhaps, your co-author? We knew that Worster had testified in Seattle saying that the amount had been only 1 pound breaker instead of 13 pounds. That they had taken the sample in a place convenient for the Mosquito Commission spray truck, and that was the reason for it. However, when he said, Dr. Worster, perhaps, the answer by Woodwell was, I don't believe he knows that either. I don't believe there's any evidence to that effect. Then the attorney said, Dr. Worster, your co-author, made the following statement at the Washington State hearings. I'm quoting him verbatim. He testified, quote, we have since sampled the marsh more extensively, and we found the average was close to 1 pound per acre. The discrepancy was because our initial sampling was in a convenient place, and this turned out to be a convenient place for the Mosquito Commission spray truck, too. Unquote. Did you learn that after the fact, Dr. Woodwell? Answer, that is a true statement in my experience. I didn't know that Dr. Worster had said that, but that is a true statement. And the attorney then said, have you ever published a retraction of this 13 pounds per acre, or a further article which discloses the result of your further sampling, which brings the average down to 1 pound per acre? And Dr. Woodwell said, I never felt that was necessary.
In other words, don't let the people know the truth. Let's talk to Jeannie. Hi, Jeannie. Yeah. I have a question or comment.
Hi, Dr. Stan. Well, I really vote for this as one of the tapes of the month because we need this information to fight the environmentalists.
Of course we do. Well, that's why this is really so important. And if you want to get a copy of this, why... we'll get one to you, or you can make a copy here.
My husband and I are listening intently. It's a great program. And I might interject on population control. We were talking earlier. We went to the town hall meeting of Sam Farr, and he says he normally doesn't like to talk about population control with the public. He talks about it between his colleagues, but with the public, because if he does that, he might not get reelected.
He said that.
Yes, he said that at the town hall meeting.
Dr. Edwards, Mr. Farr is our local congressman.
That's good.
Okay, anything else, Jeannie?
No, fascinating program. Thank you, Mr. Edwards.
Thank you. Why, Stanley?
Yes.
You were asking about the EPA results. That was just one example. I have, of course, dozens of it. It was 9,300 pages of testimony similar to that.
In other words,
all of that, the hearing examiner, the Judge Sweeney, Edmund Sweeney, he arrived at the decision at the end of 7 months of hearings. His decision was that DDT is not a carcinogenic hazard to man, not a mutagenic or teratogenic hazard to man. The uses of DDT under the regulations involved here do not have a deleterious effect on freshwater fish, estuarine organisms, wild birds, or other wildlife. The evidence in the proceedings supports the conclusion that there is a present need for the essential uses of DDT. He was opposed to it being banned. However, when it was brought up before Ruckelshaus, William Ruckelshaus overruled the hearing examiner and banned it by himself, even though Ruckelshaus never attended a single day of the hearings. 7 months of hearings, he never went. His special assistant, Marsha Miller, told reporters that he had not even read the transcript. Actually, Ruckelshaus didn't write his opinion himself. He turned it over to a 29-year-old officer, a judicial officer, Charles Fabricant, in his office. And the record says Fabricant also had no special background in science. But two non-scientists in Fabricant's office, who were members of the Environmental Defense Fund, prepared the anti-DDT tracts upon which the EDF fun propaganda was based. I met plenty of things that were never mentioned in the 9,300 pages of hearings. And they turned that over to Fabricant. Fabricant wrote it up, and Ruckelshaus signed that. That was his opinion and order banning DDT.
And you even quote here from an article in the Wall Street Journal in 1994 where he, Ruckelshaus, is still defending his decision to outlaw DDT, not based upon science, but the statement is made here. The scientific basis for the ban was solid. Then and still stands. The basis for the decision was its impact on the thickness of eggshells of raptors, brown pelicans, and peregrine falcon. Now, you would expect that when a man like William Ruckelshaus writes an article for the Wall Street Journal, that he would have some scientific background for his statements.
Yes. Well, no such luck. Wall Street Journal had an article by Dr. Frederick Steinberg, who said the title of his article was "Millions Must Perish Because of the DDT Ban," talking to millions of people. And after reviewing all the statistics, Dr. Steinberg said none of the charges against DDT, namely as an agent of widespread bird deaths, or as a non-biodegradable material, or as an agent of carcinogenicity, none of these have ever been substantiated. And so Ruckelshaus had to respond to that, and he responded by saying the ban was based on solid science. And actually, if you read Ruckelshaus's statement, sometimes he says it was political, and other times he says it was not political. I like the letter he sent to the president of the American Farm Bureau Federation, whose name is Alan Grant. And I was working with the Farm Bureau Federation at the time to set up a conference in Washington, D.C. on 245T.
I'm going to have to interrupt you there. We'll be back in just a moment.
Okay, good.
Well, this is Dr. Stan here, and we want to just tell you about a few more of the items that we have at Radio Liberty that will help you to better understand what is going on in our society. We actually have a couple of new videos now, if you haven't seen them. One is called Obstruction of Justice. It's the story of the two boys who were killed in Mena, Arkansas, and laid on the railway track. And then, of course, anybody who came forward and discussed this or knew anything about the murder of the two boys himself was murdered. There were six more murders before they finally figured out that the chief prosecutor was getting all the testimony of the witnesses, was involved in this whole affair. It's one of the most incredible bits of investigative reporting you will ever see. And, of course, it all goes back right to the very governor of Arkansas who was covering up this whole thing, William Jefferson Clinton. And then, of course, we have a second video. It's called The Mena Connection, and it simply goes into the drugs that are being brought in. You'll see Roger Clinton actually on a DEA film that was shot in a bugged hotel room. Roger Clinton is taking cocaine, talking about his brother, Bill Clinton, saying something about he has a nose like a vacuum cleaner. He's talking about the President of the United States, ladies and gentlemen, the man who didn't inhale marijuana. You want to see the Obstruction of Justice, the Mena Connection. We have the Clinton Chronicles, the death of Vince Foster. We have Oklahoma City, what really happened. Call 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. Get a list of our tapes, our videos. Get the information and help us to get the information out across America. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and we're just coming down to the end of the program. But
you're doing a great job, and those videos are wonderful. I wanted to tell you,
yes.
William Ruckelshaus wrote a letter to Alan Grant, and he said that the decisions by the government involving toxic substances are political with a small p. And that's been repeated in so many places after we exposed it. He says science with other disciplines, such as economics, has a role to play, but the ultimate judgment remains political. That's his famous quote.
And so many people are going to die because of William Ruckelshaus. What about eating of DDT? You have one here, a section on eating DDT to prove it's not toxic to human beings.
Yeah, I got tired of hearing how toxic it was, so I decided I would just eat some every time I gave a speech. And I was giving speeches at least once a week. And I'd eat a tablespoonful of DDT. it got the crowd's attention, you know. They expect me to quiver, I guess, or something, but it never had any effect. But it wasn't anything brave because I was reading the U.S. Public Health Service report. They were feeding volunteers 35 milligrams a day for 2 years with no effects. I doubt if I was taking 35 milligrams on a tablespoonful, but I didn't think I was taking any chances then. However, the average person in the United States at that time was taking about 0.5 milligrams per day. And so this is a great dosage. And Robert Loibel and his wife took 10 milligrams every day for 3 months, and that was the equivalent of about a one-year supply each day.
Well, I think it's one of the greatest frauds of all time.
All right.
And I think what you stated about your being told that there are just too many people in the world, and that somehow justifies outlawing DDT, is the very crux of this whole situation. Professor Edwards, I really want to thank you so very much.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. Come on, I enjoy talking about it. I spent much time at it.
Well, thank you very much. I will want to get you back onto our afternoon program that has an entirely different listening audience, but this program will be heard, of course, is being heard in the Monterey Bay area tonight. We'll be heard in New York and Florida next week. So thank you so very much for being our guest.
My pleasure. Thank you.
You're welcome. Good night, sir.
Yes, yeah, good night.
Okay, fine. Well, that was Dr. Gordon Edwards, a professor at San Jose State. He's retired now, but he still goes back and teaches because he loves what he does, and he's a real scientist. The document I have here is about 50 pages or 48 pages, beautifully done, beautifully referenced, and it's all, a lot of work to actually copy it, but for anybody who would like to see a copy of it, why, perhaps we can make arrangements for you to get one or pay for the copying, something of that sort. Under any circumstances, we need to remind you that we are listener-supported. We depend upon you and your generosity to keep bringing Radio Liberty to you. So if you agree with what we're doing and would like to help us to stay on this station and to expand our message across America, why, you can write to us at Post Office Box 13 in Santa Cruz, 95063. That's Post Office Box 13 in Santa Cruz, 95063. Or, if you'd like to join the Radio Liberty family of supporters, and this is what really helps us because we have a regular income from it, why, you can, and believe me, the income doesn't come to me. It goes to pay the electric bills, and, of course, we do our program in Los Angeles every week, and that's rather expensive, but we reach an awful lot of people, and people down there are really beginning to respond to the message after a period of time because they begin to see that what we're telling them is true. So if you'd like to join the Radio Liberty family of supporters for a gift of $20 or more a month, we'll send you the four best tapes of the month, and we'll encourage you to copy those tapes and help us to get the message out across America. And then, of course, we want to thank those in the past who've given so generously to Radio Liberty. Many times, I know, with great personal sacrifice, we also certainly want to thank those people like Kevin, who's up here tonight. He's here every week, at all of the people who work here at Radio Liberty, both in the afternoon and evening. This is a dedication, it's a ministry for those people, but they put their whole heart and soul in to Radio Liberty because they believe that this message is important. Well, don't even think about changing that dial. Remember to keep us in your prayers and pray for our provision and for our protection. And so we'll be back in the next hour with Mr. Kai Bender, with another incredible story here on Radio Liberty.